couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week's new movies include Turning Red, The Adam Project, some TV including Picard Season 2, and From. There'll also be some news, the Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring A Writer's Odyssey and The Matrix Resurrections. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
You're going to want to set your DVR or find a place to watch this. The 27th Annual Critics' Choice Awards will air live on the CW Network and TBS this Sunday, March 13th. It starts at 7 o'clock and goes until 10 p.m. Eastern Time. If you're on the West Coast, the Pacific Time is delayed, so you're going to want to check your local listings. This is, of course, the organization that I'm part of. I vote in this organization. And just a little bit of a note, a programming note, in a week after this, you know, later in the week, there's also something called the Super Awards, which the Critics' Choice do, an award notes of excellence to genre films. I mean, superhero films certainly are the reason and the focal point of the Super Awards, but they also deal with science fiction and fantasy and a little bit more of the what you would consider the blockbuster boosting films. But of course, the Critics' Choice Awards is your standard awards for all of the movies. Now, the ones you're going to want to keep an eye on, there's four of them that really kind of float to the top as the ones that I think are going to be the big winners. This isn't necessarily because of what I have voted, although some of them might be, but this is also kind of where I'm hearing the buzz. Belfast is really out there in front, as is The Power of the Dog. And this should be interesting and might be able to be a little bit of a precursor to the Oscars. Coda is also one. People are not wanting to forget about that. That's on Apple TV Plus. That one came out earlier last year and it was remembered. And for something to be remembered that long through award season, that shows it's got some powers. But the one that I really want to keep an eye on that I think is going to at least win for animation and if not, maybe pick up something else here and there, is The Mitchells versus the Machines, a fantastic movie on Netflix right now. You can go check it out. If you've not seen it, it's great. It's not just for kids. It's for families and everybody. But those are the four big ones that I think you're going to want to watch. So on Sunday, March 13th, 7 o'clock Eastern Time, the Critics' Choice Awards. And then, of course, at the end of the week, there will be an announcement of the Super Awards. And that'll wrap up award season for myself, even as I'm sort of skating past the Oscars. The next piece of news I want to talk about is the box office. And last weekend, The Batman did very, very well. It came out with $134 million, which was more than they originally estimated. It was in the 120s, was the early estimations. When they finally got their final numbers, that tells you that it was at $134 million, which is really good. I mean, it's a fantastic number for pandemic. It doesn't break any records because, of course, it was the Spider-Man movie that knocked that thing off the list. And what this is showing, it's showing that superhero movies, the event films, the movies with the well-known characters that people have consistently gone and seen over the last 15, 20 years, are the ones that are doing well. Because even if you go down the list, Spider-Man No Way Home, which has been out for 3 months and has made almost $800 million, it came in number fourth. It was beating, you know, the other ones that have come out more recently, something like Cyrano, which has a paltry $2.5 million as its box office total at this point. And even something like Uncharted dropped down a little bit after topping the box office for 2 weekends. Uncharted is only at about $11 million. So while they're great numbers for the Batman and great numbers for Warner Brothers, which it needed because the Warner Brothers releases in 2021 did not do well, starting with Wonder Woman 1984 and carrying through like In the Heights and, you know, The Suicide Squad was soft. And of course, Dune did okay, but didn't do as well as I think they wanted it to. A lot of that is because they were streaming, but people always say, oh, look at how little it made. Well, it also still helped boost the HBO Max numbers for 2021. So, and I said this before, let's not go race out and have a bake sale for Warner Brothers to make sure that they meet their balance sheet this year. But there's a couple things to take away from that. First of all, the Batman number is very good, but it is still lower than any other of the previous post-Dark Knight releases. And we're talking about movies in the last 15 years. If it's been a Batman movie, or at least headline, like, you know, the one that wins, the highest grossing weekend Batman movie was Batman versus Superman. And I think that had more to do with the fact that you're putting those two characters together. But these numbers, they're good, but I'm curious as to what they would have been outside of the pandemic window. But like I said, $134 million is quite good, but it's not top of the heap yet. But even then, it sucked the air out of the room for everything else. And that's important to keep in mind going forward as we talk about box office for other movies that don't involve big superheroes or franchises. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. This week's Trailer Park is hitting two of my favorite franchises that start with star. The first one is Star Trek Strange New World, a new series coming to Paramount Plus on May 5th.
No matter how many stars there are in the sky, no matter what the mathematical probabilities or the number of times we say, we are not alone in the universe. Our first visit from the stars is always the province of children's stories and science fiction. Until one day, it isn't.
I know a couple people are really Star Trek fans, and I follow them a little bit, but I don't have my ear too close to the ground on the Star Trek stuff. I've recently gotten into watching some of the other Star Trek offerings like Picard and Discovery and Lower Decks. And I'm curious to see this one mainly because it feels like it's going to be going back to what the original conception of Star Trek was. Exploring and discovery. Even the show Star Trek Discovery is less about discovering and it's more about going to war, especially in that first season. So I'm excited to go back to the original Enterprise pre-Kirk with Captain Pike in the let's explore Strange New Worlds. Because I think that in the push to make Star Trek more mainstream and exciting, they're pushing it more as military science fiction. And while it is, it should be, at least how Roddenberry originated it, was supposed to be more cerebral. Now, going on the other star, that would be Star Wars. We've got Obi-Wan Kenobi on Disney Plus starting on May 25th.
Jedi cannot help what they are. Their compassion leaves a trail. The Jedi Code is like an itch. He cannot help it. Where is he?
Now, this one, of course, tells the story of Obi-Wan Kenobi after he dropped off Luke Skywalker on Tatooine and is trying to keep his watchful eye over him. And, of course, Darth Vader trying to track him down. Supposedly in the trailer, you should be able to see Darth Vader in there, or what the new Darth Vader would be. I'm curious to see how all this works out. I know that the imagery is very, very fleeting and quick. It's also interesting to note that right now in 2022, we're 20 years from Attack of the Clones, which is the length of time it took Obi-Wan Kenobi to go from Ewan McGregor to Alec Guinness, or for Owen Lars, Luke's uncle, to go from Joel Egerton to the old fart who played him in the first movie. So it's interesting. They're still kind of playing with the look of people, but you know, I'm looking forward to this. I am not bothered by the return to Tatooine. There's a lot of people who think we need to get off of Tatooine. It's okay. Have some Tatooine stuff. Do some stuff with the original characters, but do other things as well. You can have both. You don't have to do one or the other. You don't have to blow up the whole franchise to do so. So I'm looking forward. I mean, we just got a little taste of Obi-Wan Kenobi, but I am looking forward to it, and I will be watching it come May 25th. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about From and Picard Season 2. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the reviews and talk about some television or streaming stuff. Streaming TV is very different than broadcast TV. With these streaming series, you're getting a different type of show that doesn't have the standards and practices chokehold on it, and they can make it more cinematic. And I think you're absolutely seeing that. So let's talk about Picard Season 2. After the fallout from the Romulan attack in Season 1, Picard and his ragtag team are pulled into an alternate timeline due to a collision of a Borg Queen's plan and meddling by Q.
Well, hello, my friend.
What is this? What have you done?
Welcome to the road not taken.
Do you have any idea what's happening here? Reality has been broken.
A divergence. I know someone who could help us understand the change in time.
Your answers are not in the stars.
I never watched the first season of Picard until very recently. I've always been a big fan of the original Star Trek series and the Next Generation. And I always loved Picard. He's my favorite starship captain. I mean, Kirk, especially recently, I've been going back and rewatching the original Star Trek episodes from I pretty much just finished season one of the original 60s show. And Kirk's a lousy captain. I mean, half the episodes are about Kirk wanting to bang somebody. And as forward thinking as these shows were back in the 1960s, they still were steeped in dripping in sexism of the day. So I don't blame Shatner for this as much as the tropes you had from a character that originated in the 60s. And when they brought in Captain Picard in the Next Generation, they gave you a real true captain, somebody who took that job seriously and wasn't just out there to screw around and get laid out in the star systems. So the first season of Picard, I really enjoyed it. I know a lot of people got down on it because they said it was boring and it didn't move fast enough. But that's okay. And this is something you can do in streaming, even though they didn't drop all the episodes at once. So you couldn't binge watch these when it originally aired. Of course, if you come to the series, you know, a couple weeks or months later or longer, you can binge watch it. So you kind of have to make this for both audiences. But I wasn't bothered by the slow movement. I thought that they spent a lot of time getting intricate into characters, and they started really looking at Picard as a character and looking at him by his mistakes, not by his accomplishments, which is always how they kind of looked at Picard in his series and movies. But this is an old man who in this series, he is way out of his depth. He does not know what he's doing, and he does not have the support that he did when you are a commander of a starship. He's kind of in this ragtag group, and he means well and he has good intentions, but he's not always able to affect that. And that's what I found so fascinating. And the other thing Picard has been subtly doing, and they did that with the first season, is they put to bed the character of Data. They wrapped up a bunch of loose ends, and they did so in an exploratory, fair, and very respectful manner. And I really enjoyed that. Now, in this new season of Picard, They're going back to some old tropes. I mean, there's obvious comparisons to Mirror Mirror because they go to this parallel, you know, or not, the time gets changed, the timeline changes, and it's a warring ship. It's the Federation is a confederation, so it's not trying to bring peace, but it's actively at war with everything from the Romulans and the Klingons, which you'd expect, and the Cardassians, even with the Vulcans and the Andorians and all those other races that were otherwise peaceful races. So that's shades of Mirror Mirror. We, of course, saw that happen in the original Star Trek series, Mirror Mirror episode with the bearded Spock and everything. So I like that they tie it in there, and they tie some of the characters, and they bring back cameos, and there's more throughout the series. They've only aired two episodes of Picard Season 2, but I really like this because it's playing around with one of the really dangerous villains in the series, which are the Borg, and really taking some chances there, and I appreciate that. I like them taking chances, and I like the fact that Picard is trying to control a very chaotic group of people rather than a regimented Starfleet crew. And that gives something that's very, very interesting, a lot of fun to watch. So I'm having a blast watching this one. I'm real curious to see where this goes. So I'm going to have to say, even more than Discovery, which I think I started rewatching that, and that still has its problems. I've gotten a little more accepting of it. But Picard, to me, is the flagship series of the new Star Trek stuff. So I'm going to say Picard Season 2, so far, totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the series from... This epic series follows a group of people trapped in a mysteriously inescapable town that have to hide indoors each night, or ghostly creatures will literally tear them apart.
Where are we?
I know none of this makes sense yet. Everyone in this town has been exactly where you are right now. Everyone sees the tree. Those crows.
We'll just get out of here, please.
Kevin, we are stuck.
It's important for you to understand what happens after dark.
Lock your door.
Nail your window shut. You do these things, your family's going to be safe.
Safe from what?
First of all, before we even talk about the series, can we talk real quickly about Epics? Epics has been around for over a decade. It's been around streaming content since Netflix was in its infancy. Back when it was mostly sending out discs and it started doing the Netflix instant watch stuff as kind of just a test to see what it, and that of course took over the business. But, you know, I feel bad for them because they're like Crackle. They've been around forever and nobody cares about them. But Epics has constantly been trying to make a splash with documentaries and original content, and I think they're stepping up their game. Now, this series from, I think you could also get it on like the Roku channel and some other things, but you might have to pay for it. But Epics is the main site that you can get this from. Several people are involved in it. Like, I think the Russo brothers are involved in it on a very high level. But Jack Bender is probably the best known name. And you'd recognize his name from Lost. It also has Harold Penaroo as the main character, sort of like this anchor character. And he was on Lost. And this series has these elements of Lost where you got a whole bunch of people in this almost fantastically mysterious trapped situation. But also like Lost, it falls into the traps of not putting the stuff out there first. It takes too long throughout this series. I think they've aired 4 or 5 episodes. I've watched beyond that, but I haven't finished the series. But there's stuff that you find out, like in episode 3 or 4, that you're like, geez, that would have been nice to know the second these people showed up into town. And they're sort of lackadaisical or laissez-faire about even just explaining to people what's going on from their ignorant perspective of being trapped there. You know, it's like, to give you an example, when Lost happened, you would think that if your plane went down, somebody would sit there and say, okay, let's line everybody else. Who's that's got military experience? Who's got medical experience? Who's got nutritional experience? Who can hunt? You would have gotten some idea of who you were with, but no, they just, oh, we're just going to sit here and not talk to each other. They kept putting up these very obvious roadblocks to what would have been reasonable understanding. Also, a lot of the characters tend to be a-holes, and it's really hard to get behind the characters when they're not nice people. You're just like, stop being, I know you're stuck in a bad situation, but don't be a jerk about it. I mean, it's an interesting show, but I'm very curious as to what the catch is. You're either going to not explain it, and it's like Lost was going to be over as soon as you explain what was going on with that island, and I have a feeling that From is going to be lose its steam as soon as you explain what's going on with the town. So it's very intriguing, it's very interesting, but it does take its time to get to where it's going. But right now, I'll say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Turning Red and the Atom Project. Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about the new stuff. Nothing in theaters this weekend, guys. There's no movies in theaters. It's all online. It's all streaming. This is the new norm. There's some people have complained about them sort of clearing the schedule and some of the reason March has gotten a lot of empty spots in the release schedule is because they pushed the films farther out because they didn't know how long the Omicron variant was going to impact. But you know, here's the thing. At this point, you cannot predict what's going to happen with the next surge in the coronavirus. You can't predict what's going to happen with the next variant. We might get another variant popping up, and it might move as fast as the Omicron variant did, or it might spread itself out. We don't know. And, you know, trying to anticipate this is making it very difficult to release stuff in theaters. But I think that going forward, we're going to have weeks like this where nothing's coming to the big theater. And this is just going to let the Batman run roughshod over the box office for another weekend. But in the meantime, we've got stuff going to streaming. It's either been sold there or been brought there, or it's something like Disney taking Turning Red, which is a Pixar film, and packaging it onto Disney Plus, not because they have something against Pixar, but mainly because they know that if they keep putting stuff on Disney Plus, and they can get people to not cancel their subscription, and they can bill the $1 billion a month that they've been doing. So let's talk about Turning Red first. The latest offering from Pixar follows a 13-year-old Chinese-Canadian girl who discovers she turns into a giant panda when emotionally charged.
I'm Maylin Lee. I wear what I want, say what I want, 24/7, 365.
Is everything okay?
I'm a gross red monster!
This happened already?
What did you say?
Our ancestors had a mystical connection with red pandas.
Are you kidding me?
This little quirk runs in our family.
Any strong emotion,
yes,
will release the panda.
There's a lot going on with this movie, and I would compare a lot of the ideas and thoughts and sort of the end result of this movie to Inside Out. Inside Out was a movie about the changing emotional makeup of a child as they go through puberty. And it was a beautiful, abstract, out-of-the-box, bizarre way of handling it that gave it a universal appeal. This one is much more narrowly focused on this 13-year-old Chinese-Canadian girl. And it's important to point that out because it's good that they're, you know, they're being inclusive and they're bringing in characters. You know, you're having stories that aren't just about white people. But this is also very steeped in its culture. Because the kid, May, she is under the thumb of her parents, and she works, her parents work in like a temple type thing that they preserve the temple, and her family's dripping in the cultural stuff, and it's very, very Chinese centric. Reminds me a little bit of the short film that Pixar did, Bao, a couple years ago, which I think won the Oscar for short film. And it was the one about the mother who made a little dumpling, and she raised the dumpling and then like eats the dumpling at the end. And it's supposed to be this analogy of her and her son. And what's funny about that, it's a charming little sweet little story, except for the part where she eats the dumpling at the end. And it turned off a lot of people, except those that are Chinese or of Chinese descent. And they loved it because they understood it. It's something that clicks culturally that doesn't translate to other cultures. So it is a bit jarring. And I know a lot of people who didn't like it because they did not understand it. And first of all, that's okay. You don't have to understand everything. And if you don't get the cultural reference to it, or if you don't understand it because you're not raised in that culture, that doesn't make you a bigot. That just makes you somebody who's not in that culture. And it's okay to have that out there. It's okay for you to not like it because it didn't connect you. And it's okay for the people who are in that culture to love it because it connects to them. You should not shame either side for either way. But you do have to realize if you make something that connects directly to like a Chinese American culture, it may not connect to a culture outside of that. And I think that's one of the things that's happening with Turning Red, because it is very steeped in the Chinese culture and the mythology and the history and the meaning of a red panda and that sort of thing that is lost to somebody like me, an Irish-Hungarian kid from Ohio. And that's okay. The other thing that's going on with this movie is it's Teen Wolf, the 1985 movie with Michael J. Fox. It's a remake of Teen Wolf. I mean, it's different. In Michael J. Fox's movie, he was a teenage boy and he was turning into a werewolf, but it was something in his family that happened to all the teenagers in the male side of that family. And he ends up even taking it to school and becoming popular because of it, which is what happens in Turning Red. Now, it goes off in a very different direction, especially near the end. And there's nothing culturally significant about the werewolf, But really, when you watch this movie, it's about this girl learning to be herself and learning to love herself as who she is. And it is that journey. But it's Teen Wolf. So if you can't relate to it culturally, relate to it because of the 1985 movie Teen Wolf. Finally, the other thing about this movie is I said to the rep who asked me when I saw it, they asked what I thought. And I go, it's weird. It feels more like a Disney movie than a Pixar movie. And I don't know if that makes any sense to anybody, but there's something transcending about a Pixar movie where even if it is about a certain culture, it can transcend and you can relate to it outside of it. And this one's not. If this is like aimed more for sort of like the Disney Channel audience, which is more narrow and valid, but it's more narrow. Also, the little girl in there, she's cute, but my God, she's annoying. Just listen to that trailer I played. And holy cats, you're just like, if I have to hear that girl screaming one more time, I'm going to cut my ears off. So, you know, it's not a perfect movie. It has some problems and it clearly has some obstacles to get over depending on who you are watching it. But it's cute enough. It's worth seeing. Hey, for an update of Teen Wolf, it's perfectly great. So I'm going to say Turning Red kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Adam Project. This is on Netflix. Ryan Reynolds plays a pilot from the future who steals a time machine and goes back 28 years to team up with his younger self in order to stop disaster.
Do you remember this? I mean, if this is happening to me, it already happened to you, right? Unless it works more like a multiverse where each replicates an alternate timeline.
A multiverse? My God, we watched too many movies.
So, Bunny 50, is it really bad?
It's not great.
Find him.
You know what you have to do. Stop time travel from ever being invented.
Just as Turning Red is about Teen Wolf from 1985, The Adam Project has shades of Back to the Future. Not completely, although there is one scene where he meets his mother, played by Jennifer Gardner, and you're like, oh no, she's going to fall in love with him. I mean, it doesn't completely go down the route of Back to the Future, and even Back to the Future was the guy meeting his father. This is the guy meeting his younger self. And I'll tell you, the kid playing 12-year-old Ryan Reynolds deserves an Oscar for his portrayal, because that kid just nails it. It's like they gave him all of Ryan Reynolds' movies and say, perfect your impression of this guy. And he just is dead on with his mannerisms and responses and nonverbal and verbal cues. Overall, it's a cute little movie. It's that science fiction and fun adventure film. You know, you got all this sort of time travel stuff. And it's so funny because nowadays time travel has gotten so well known and multiverse stuff has gotten so well known that now even crappy sci-fi concept stuff. I mean, and this isn't, and I say this movie's not crappy, but the concepts behind it are kind of crappy. They don't dissect time travel in a very intellectual way, but they pretend that they know it from the intellectual perspective. It's directed by Sean Levy, who directed Ryan Reynolds most recently in Free Guy, which became a huge hit. But this is one of those movies that does not feel like it was something that was just made for a throwaway streaming service. This feels like it was going to be a theatrical release and Netflix just outbid everybody else. It's sweet. It's got some great moments. Ryan Reynolds, even though he's great in a movie like Deadpool, he can also do, you know, more family friendly type stuff. And it's a relatively simple story. I mean, it's just about him trying to stop this time loop from happening. And it doesn't try to be any more complex than that. It just follows a very simple trajectory, but that's okay. Sometimes you just want something simple. You can watch with the family. It's something you can enjoy for the spectacle as an adult, but the kids are going to enjoy it too. So I'm going to have to say The Adam Project kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the Home Cinema Roundup featuring A Writer's Odyssey and The Matrix Resurrections. Fat Guy Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's wrap things up and talk about the home cinema selections. But first, I want to specify something here. I didn't have enough time to mention this in the first segment as I was talking about the Batman and its effect on the content that you're going to be seeing coming to the theaters. And I talked a little bit about this last week about why streaming is so much stronger now than it was a couple years ago going into the pandemic. A lot of people look at it wrong. They look at streaming as something that the pandemic spawned. And that's not what happened. Streaming was happening years before the pandemic. And Netflix was really making inroads to challenge the theaters, at least in award season, before the pandemic. One of the things that happened is during the pandemic, studios continued to have content they needed to push out there, so they relied on streaming. But the studios don't care. That's, I guess, the bottom line. The studios don't really care as long as they can find a viable revenue source to distribute their content. It's the theaters that care more than anything else. And there's, when you see this reported in the box office, there are people who are reporting, and the people who are overly critical of streaming tend to just want to go back to theatrical experience and the theatrical perspective, partly because it's easier to report those numbers. But there are two main reasons the pandemic affected streaming so influentially. The first one is because you had at least several months of people not being able to go to the theaters, it forced people to seek out options. Nobody talked about Tubi TV or Pluto TV before the pandemic. Nobody was talking about those things. It wasn't until the pandemic that people realized, oh, hey, there are these services that show this free stuff all the time. Add to the fact that during the pandemic, we had an explosion of streaming services. You had Disney Plus just got started and really kind of had some inroads during the pandemic with stuff like WandaVision. But then you also had stuff like Peacock launching during the pandemic. You had Paramount Plus rebranding during the pandemic. And you had HBO Max giving a huge push to their streaming service, which kind of had a soft middling launch right before the pandemic. Then it forced people to upgrade their equipment. There are people that were watching stuff on old TVs and they didn't have a streaming stick, or they didn't have a Roku, or they didn't have an Apple TV, or they didn't have a TV that handled the streaming capabilities just as a smart TV. And so they went ahead and they bought a bigger one because they're going to stay at home all the time anyways. So people got the tech that allowed them to stream. And then it went on for a year or two, depending on who you are and how quickly you went back to theaters. And I was reading an article that said it can take anywhere, depending on the habit. I know this is a big window, but it says it takes anywhere from 18 to 254 days to form a habit. And I don't care what that habit is, the pandemic and the theater closures lasted at least that long for a lot of people. So something's got to bring people back to theaters. And you can't just put bigger movies and more. There's got to be something to bring people back to theaters, and I don't know if it's going to happen. But in the meantime, we've got streaming services. So you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. And because we're talking streaming and we're talking stuff that you watch at home, let's talk about the home cinema roundup. The first one I want to talk about is from Shout Factory. It's a Chinese film called A Writer's Odyssey. A man searching for his kidnapped daughter is hired by a shadow organization to terminate a writer whose latest book is having a real-life impact on a billionaire.
The target is a writer.
His book is titled Godslayer, and the writer's name is Kong Wen.
My boss is convinced that what happens in the story is somehow affecting his health. You only have 3 days. You don't want to let us down.
Who is Redmayne?
He's no mortal like you.
The story's not done. I have to finish it.
This is a Chinese action movie based on a couple books, but there's kind of two parts of the story. There's the part of the story of the guy searching for his daughter who has become victim to human trafficking. And somehow he's got like almost a mutant style power where he can throw things at great distances with great accuracy. And they hint to this, that there's a bunch of people out there who have these mutant type of powers. But they just sort of almost throw that in passing. And yeah, it's sort of like this spy type movie, but it does have that underlying mutant explanation. And he's sent to go after this writer and later befriends him. But then it also tells a story of this book this guy's writing that's somehow having an impact on this one guy in the real world. And so the story is a feudal military movie about this guy going up against this giant monstrous bad guy that lays waste to villages and towns in China. And there's some really neat stuff, especially when you get down to the feudal stuff, the story within the story. And that's really neat. They got some great set pieces, some really neat action. The special effects aren't perfect CGI, but they're good CGI for what's probably a limited budget. And they're pretty visionary. The biggest problem is some of the stuff is a bit of a leap logic and concept wise that I do struggle to get past some of that. But you know, I think it's a neat movie. It runs a bit long. It's like 2 hours and 10 minutes. It does not earn that. But even as much as it has to do with the feudal culture of China, you know, that's like watching a Western in America. So you can easily relate to all that. So I'm going to have to say that A Writer's Odyssey is imperfect, but it's still an interesting movie to check out if you want to search for it. So I'll say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the release of The Matrix Resurrections, which is now available on 4K and Blu-ray, and it's been on streaming. Of course, it was on HBO Max earlier, got dropped off the service before they get back to you can rent it off of all the other different services. The Matrix Resurrections, 20 years after the events of the Matrix trilogy, Thomas Anderson is still caught in a loop as a video game designer trying to wake up to reality.
If you want the truth, Neo, you're going to have to follow me.
The only thing that matters to you is still here. I know it's why you're still fighting and why you will never give up.
You don't know me.
No?
After all these years, to be going back to where it all started. Back to the Matrix.
People who have been listening to this show know that I'm a huge fan of the Matrix series. I even like the sequels. Yes, yeah, they got their problems, but I found them visionary and amazing. One of the things I loved so much about the Matrix Resurrections, my adoration for Lana Wachowski's refusal to deliver exactly what people thought they wanted. Now, it reminds me of when Star Wars The Phantom Menace came out, which is almost 20 years after the original Star Wars came out, and it wasn't what the adult versions of the children wanted. You know, all these people who were like in their 30s were like, oh, this is stupid. They didn't know what they were doing. And I'm like, well, you're not going to have the same reaction to something you saw as a child. And that's what happened with The Matrix. You have a whole generation who saw the original Matrix movies when they were like 12. And it didn't live up to that because you're a different person at 12 than when you are when you're in your early 30s. So I love the fact that Lana Wachowski just went and made the movie she wanted to make and made the movie as subversive and with so many buried concepts in there. So I think it's just a brilliantly done middle finger to the fans and to Warner Brothers. But she's really venting her spleen on all the crap that she's had to go through over the last 20 years with people telling her what The Matrix was. And she's like, look, I'm the one who came up with it, for crying out loud. And yeah, there's some weird things in there. And I know it's not for everybody, but I really enjoy The Matrix Resurrections. And on top of it, it's got some really neat special features. Now, most of it's all just behind the scenes stuff. There's a lot of interviews and they break up. There's probably about, I'd say, almost 2 hours of behind the scenes featurettes broken up into everything from 5 minute chunks to half hour featurettes. And they address what it was like for the people to get back involved, like Carrie Ann Moss and Keanu Reeves. They address the self-referential nature of it. They address how much has changed in Lana and Lily Wachowski's life since they did the first movies. It talks about how cinema has changed and how making these types of movies have changed and how the pattern of making movies have changed, and realizing that the people making this movie are not the same people who made the first movie, and you are never going to get The Matrix for the very first time ever again because it was a once-in-a-lifetime, once-in-a-generation type of movie. So I think this is absolutely worth checking out. Nobody understood it. Nobody respected it when it came out. I think maybe in about 30 years, people are going to look back at this and be like, yeah, this is kind of brilliant. So I'm going to be one of those people who will have a flag in the sand saying I was one of them that first said that. So The Matrix Resurrection totally rocks. Worth getting the Blu-ray or the 4K or the DVD if you're still on that technology. Totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
And that's it. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Deepwater on Hulu with not much else in the theaters. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.